You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole translators of Steiner into English and give me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 181 by Rudolf Steiner, consisting of three cycles of lectures: Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, The Need for New Forms of Consciousness. We are on the first cycle, Dying Earth and Living Cosmos. This is Lecture 4, given in Berlin on the 5th of March, 1918. In a recent lecture here, I spoke about the relationship that can exist, or in fact always does, between embodied human souls and disembodied souls, the so-called dead. Today I wish to continue with these reflections by adding some further thoughts. Through various insights we have gained from spiritual science, we know that the human spirit undergoes its own development in the course of Earth's evolution. It is also apparent that we can only really know ourselves by asking the fruitful question as to how, in a particular incarnation, in the incarnation we live in at present, we relate to the spiritual worlds, the realms of spirit. What level or stage of humanity's general evolution has been achieved, one may ask, when we ourselves live in a particular incarnation? By detailed reflection on humanity's overall evolution, it becomes evident that in former times, in former epochs of human evolution, humankind possessed a certain clairvoyant capacity, which we have called atavistic. This was a time when the human soul was in a sense closer to worlds of spirit. But in its closer connection with spiritual worlds, humanity was more distant from its own freedom, its own free will, than it has now become, at a time when, in general, people are more sundered from spiritual worlds. If we can really appraise human nature in the modern world, we find that the same relationship to the whole world of spirit actually still exists, unconsciously, in people's intrinsic spiritual being. But they are not generally able to be consciously aware of this connection and relationship in the same way as they once were. Certain individuals can, but in general, humankind does not recognize this connection as it did in former times. If we try to discover why people today fail to become consciously aware of the relationship between their soul and the world of spirit, a relationship that naturally still exists as strongly as ever, albeit in a different form, we find this is because we have now passed beyond the midpoint of earthly evolution and find ourselves in a descending evolutionary stream of earth existence. Our physical organism, although of course this is not apparent to external anatomy and physiology, has become more physical than it used to be once. And between birth or conception and death, we no longer have an organization capable of bringing our connection with the spiritual world to our full awareness. In unconscious regions of the soul, however materialistic we actually experience far more than we are consciously aware. But this goes still further, and here I come to a very important point in modern humanity's evolution. Modern people are, in general, unable to really think through all that they would otherwise have the capacity to inwardly experience. They cannot fully sense, feel, and experience it. Today, people have a disposition that would enable them to have far more intense thoughts and feelings than is possible within what I might call the coarse materiality of their organism. What this means is that at this current stage of humanity's evolution, we are unable to fully develop the potential we possess in earthly life. This is irrespective of whether we die at a young age or when we're old. Due to the coarse nature of our organism, we cannot fully unfold capacities we would unfold if our body were more finely, delicately organized. This is true whether we die young or in old age. Whether we cross the threshold of death when young or old, a residue of unprocessed thoughts, feelings, and emotions remains in our earthly organization. These thoughts, feelings, and emotions are not worked through fully by the time we die, whenever that is. They remain undigested, unassimilated in a sense. This is true for all of us. And after we have died, we retain, really, an urge to think, feel, and experience in the earthly realm, in earthly ways. Let us think for a moment of the implications of this. Only after death do we become free to develop certain thoughts and feelings. We would achieve much more on earth if we could fully unfold these thoughts and feelings during our physical existence. But we can't. It is true to say that each and every one of us could achieve a great deal more if we could realize our inherent potential. This was not the case in former times, when the human organism was finer and subtler in nature, and when people were able to look consciously to some degree into the world of spirit and act out of the spirit. In those times, as a rule, people were able to achieve all that their potential allowed. However proud people are today of their potential capacities, nowadays things are as I have described. Given this, we can understand that the unintegrated thoughts and feelings the dead carry with them across the threshold should not be lost to earthly life. We can only ensure they are not, however, if, as often stated, we really cultivate our connections with the dead in ways that are guided by spiritual science. If we really sustain these relationships and seek to make our connection with the dead with whom we are karmically connected into a conscious, fully conscious one, then the unrealized thoughts of the dead are conducted through our soul into the world. These stronger, more vigorous thoughts a dead soul can have through being released from the body can act within our own soul. We cannot fully realize and unfold our own thoughts, but these thoughts can work in us. Let me read that again. We cannot fully realize and unfold our own thoughts, but these thoughts can work in us. Thus, what materialism has brought us should at the same time highlight for us the importance, the absolute necessity today and in the near future, of seeking a real, tangible relationship to the spirits of the dead. The question is only how we can entertain in our souls, in the right way, the thoughts and feelings seeking entry from the realm where the dead dwell. We have previously spoken of this too. Not long ago, I spoke of important moments we should try to observe carefully, those of falling asleep and of waking up. Today I would like to give a fuller characterization of things related to this. The dead cannot directly enter this world in which we live with our ordinary waking consciousness, which we perceive externally and in which we act through our will based on drives and promptings. They have been drawn away from this world by crossing the threshold at death. And yet, we can still share a world in common with these dead. If, spurred on by spiritual science, we attempt, something that is certainly difficult in our materialistic age, to take both the inner world of our thinking in hand and also our life, the way we live, rather than letting them run on unguided as we are accustomed. We can develop certain abilities that grant us common ground with the spirits who have crossed the threshold of death. In ordinary modern life, of course, there are a great number of obstacles to finding this common ground. The first is something I may not have touched upon very much yet, although it does follow naturally from our other observations. It is this: that in general we are usually too spendthrift of our thoughts today. We are too dissipated and dispersed in our thoughts. What do I mean by this? A German proverb holds that our thoughts are, in quotes, duty-free, or in other words, that we can allow anything at all to pass through them, and that there is no harm in doing so. But it is easy to see that what we say is a reflection of what we think, and that most people's speech nowadays, the way they flit from one idea to another, betrays a random thought life that allows one thing to follow another without much rhyme or reason. This is a waste of the power with which we are endowed for the purpose of thinking. Our thoughts are diffuse and dissipated. We permit ourselves quite arbitrary thoughts. We desire whatever occurs randomly to us, or forget it again as another thought takes its place. In other words, we are disinclined to control our thoughts. Someone starts speaking, and we listen to him for a minute or two as he passes from one idea or theme to the next. This can be a quite unpleasant experience. We want to discuss with him what he first started saying, but to do so we will have to remind him what it was. This happens all the time. One has to remind people of the subject one was discussing initially, and then bring them back round to it, if there is to be any serious discussion at all. This profligacy of thinking, wastefulness of the power of thinking, prevents thoughts surfacing from the depths of our soul that are not ours, but which we share in common with the realm of spirit, with the general sway of spirit. This arbitrary flitting from one thought to the next does not create the conditions in our waking life, enabling us to wait for thoughts to surface from the depths of our soul life. We fail to attend to what I will call intuitions. But this is something that really should be cultivated, especially in the modern era, for reasons I have outlined. We should create in ourselves a mood that entails waiting observantly for thoughts to rise from the deep subterranean places of the soul, thoughts that, it is clear, are given to us, not made by us. It should not be thought that we can swiftly develop such a mood in ourselves. It has to be nurtured. But if nurtured, if we really try to be awake and not just fall asleep again after shutting out arbitrary thoughts, try simply to be alert and to wait for what rises in us, this mood will slowly develop. Then a capacity forms in us to receive thoughts in our soul that arise from its depths, and therefore originate in a world that is broader than our ego nature. If we really develop this capacity, we will start to perceive more in the world than we see with our eyes, hear with our ears, receive through our external senses, and then combine by our powers of reason. We will begin to discern an objective reality of weaving, living thought. Nowadays, very few people indeed have this primary and immanent experience. To discern this universal reality of living thought, in which our soul really dwells, is not yet an esoteric experience of particular significance, but is something everyone can have by developing the mood I have described. An experience arises that goes beyond sense perception and the rational organizing and combining of such perceptions in daily life. We feel ourselves now to be standing by the shore, then to be immersing ourselves in the ocean and weaving there in its waves. Standing at the boundary of sensory existence, I can enter the weaving ocean of thought. It is really like plunging into a living ocean. At least one can have a dim sense of a life that is stronger and more intense than mere dream life. Although in the same way as dream relates to sensory perception, this life is different and distinct from outer sensory reality. If you like, you can speak of such experiences as dreams, but they are not. The world we immerse ourselves in here, this world of surging thoughts that are not our own, but are, instead, a thought world we have plunged into, is the realm from which our physical, sensory world emerges and arises, or crystallizes, if you like. Our physical, sensory world is like lumps of ice floating in water. Just as ice consists of the substance of water, though in a different state, so our physical, sensory world emerges from the surging waves of this ocean of thought. That is its real origin. Scientists speak only of what they call, in quotes, ether, of spiraling atoms, since they are unaware of the nature of this primary substantiality. Shakespeare was closer to the mark when he had Prospero say in The Tempest, quote, "We are such stuff as dreams are made on," close quote. In relation to these things, people easily deceive themselves. They conjure a world of atoms, of, in quotes, building blocks behind physical reality. But if one wishes to speak of any such, quote, reality behind the physical world, close quote, it is the objective world of living thought. We can only discern this, though, if we cease allowing our thoughts to wander randomly, and instead develop a mood that arises if we can wait for what is known, in popular parlance, as intuition. Those who have been preoccupied with spiritual science will not find it so difficult to develop this mood. You see, the kind of thinking necessary for studying anthroposophically oriented spiritual science is well suited for creating such a mood. If you study it seriously, a need will arise in you to develop this delicate weaving life of thoughts. At the same time, it creates the common sphere between ourselves on the one hand and the so-called dead on the other. It is the common ground where we can encounter the dead. They cannot enter the world we perceive through our senses and organize by our powers of reason, but they do enter the world I have just described. The second condition for removing hindrances is something I described last year: the observation of subtle, delicate connections. You may remember that to illustrate this, I cited an example that can be found in studies of human psychology. Schubert also highlights this. It can be found in older literature on the subject, but similar examples can frequently be found in life itself. A person accustomed to going for a daily walk suddenly gets the sense, on arriving at a particular point on the path, that he must stop and stand to one side. At the same time, the thought occurs to him that walking like this every day might not be the best use of his time. At that very moment, a stone that has been dislodged from a rock face above falls on the path, and would certainly have struck him if the thought had not caused him to move to one side. This is a pretty striking instance of the kind of experiences many people have had. Although usually far more subtle in nature, they impinge on our life on a daily basis, but we usually disregard them. In life, we only consider what actually happens, and not what might have happened, but didn't, because something occurred to prevent it. We disregard the fact that something happened to keep us at home for a quarter of an hour longer, so that we took our walk a little later than we intended. Strange things would frequently become apparent if we considered how things would have been different if we had not been delayed and, say, taken our walk a quarter of an hour later than planned. Try to observe this systematically in your daily life. What would have been different if, just as you were going out, someone had not arrived and detained you for a few minutes? Perhaps someone you were angry with. Such things continually impinge on life. We always seek a causal connection between things that actually happen, neglecting to observe life with a subtle discernment that might perceive in the interrupting of intended causal sequences the way life is endowed with an atmosphere of differing possibilities. If we take this into account, then really we always have a sense that if we do something or other at midday, having been delayed for 10 minutes during the morning, then this action at midday may not only be affected or influenced by preceding events, but could also have been subject to the countless things that did not happen, which we were kept from doing. By conceiving a connection between potentiality, rather than only external sensory reality and our life, we come to sense that the search for connections between what happens and what happened previously is a very narrow way of regarding things. When we really pose ourselves such a question, this stimulates something in our mind that would otherwise remain dormant. We start observing between the lines of life, if you like, acquainting ourselves with life's multiple meanings and ambiguities. Then, in a sense, we come to see ourselves embedded in surroundings that shape us, and slowly but surely help us progress. Usually we take far too little account of this. We normally only consider the inner powers driving us forward. Let us take a simple, ordinary example, which can illustrate how we often connect outward events in only a very fragmentary way with our inner life. Try to examine the way you are used to picturing how you get up in the morning. In attempting this, you will, mostly, get a very clear idea of it. The idea of what prompts you to get up out of bed, although this too may remain a very nebulous thought for you. Now, try to reflect for a couple of days on the kind of thought that gets you out of bed each day. Try to become completely aware of the specific thought that actually makes you get out of bed on each occasion. In other words, yesterday you got up because you heard coffee being made in an adjoining room. This drew your attention and gave you the impetus to get out of bed. Today it was something different. What I mean is that you should become aware specifically of what in the external world prompted you to get up. We commonly forget to seek ourselves in the outer world around us, and therefore we find so little of ourselves in this outer world. But if you pay more attention to such things, it will be easy to develop a mood which people today are so shy of having, a mood evoked by a continuous undertone of thought we do not really possess in ordinary daily life. Let us say a person enters a room or arrives at a particular place, but gives little thought to this. How does the place itself alter when he enters it? Some people have a sense of this sometimes, but it is a fairly rare way of regarding outer factors and conditions. I do not know how many people have any sense of this. In a room with a group of people in it, one of the people there is often twice as strong as another. One is strong, the other weak, and this is something that depends on imponderable factors. You can easily discover that someone in a group flits in and out again as if he were an angel, while another person is so strongly present that he not only stands there on two visible legs, but on many other invisible ones too. The other people in the group are not usually very aware of this, and the person himself not at all. A person does not usually perceive the undertone he induces in his surroundings by his presence. We normally remain in ourselves, do not inquire as to the change we ourselves introduce by being there. But we can teach ourselves to perceive a hint, an echo of our own place in and effect on our surroundings. Just imagine the subtle intimacy that external life would acquire if something like this became a customary practice. If people did not merely fill places with their presence, but also developed a sense of the effect they have by being there, by their influence in it, of the change they bring about by the very fact of their presence. That is only one example, of which there are many more in all areas of life. To put it differently, it is possible to condense the medium of life in a healthy way, not by tripping over one's own heels all the time, but in a healthy, natural way, so that we come to feel what effect we ourselves exert on life. And this is the beginning of a sense of karma, of destiny. You see, if we developed a complete sense of what is caused by our own actions or by our presence in one place or another, always having a picture, if you like, of what our actions or presence elicit from our surroundings, then we would have a clear feeling of our karma, which is woven from all these shared experiences. But for now, I only wish to indicate how life is enriched by such intimate awareness, by reading and observing between the lines of life, by learning to observe life with attentiveness to the fact that we are more fully present when we live more consciously, with conscience. Through such an awareness, once again, we develop the sphere which we share with the dead. In such awareness, developing an inner mood that is conscious of the two pillars I have described, conscientious attentiveness to life on the one hand, and thriftiness of thinking rather than profligacy on the other, we will succeed in a way necessary for both the present and future in coming closer to the dead. If we then form thoughts in which we draw on the life we shared with a dead person, doing so not only in thoughts but in our feelings, with heartfelt interest in the other, weaving further at the fabric of shared life situations, thinking of shared experiences we had in which feelings were involved, thus not just an indifferent kind of coexistence, but moments in which we were interested in what the other thought, experienced, and did, in which he too was interested in what we elicited from him, then we can use such moments to continue what we might call our conversations with the dead. And then, allowing such thoughts to rest and passing over into a kind of meditative state, as it were, offering up these thoughts we have had at the altar of inner spiritual life, a moment arrives when we receive a reply, in a sense, from the dead, and when they can communicate with us again. We need only create the bridge between what we elaborate in relation to the dead person and what enables him to cross over again in turn toward us. For this approach toward us, it will be particularly useful if we are able to develop a picture in our deepest soul of the being of the dead person. This is something really very alien to people today. As I have said on previous occasions, people pass each other by like ships in the night. They may live together in the closest proximity, and then their ways part without them really knowing one another. Knowing another person does not have to be based on intellectual analysis. If we feel analyzed by the person we live with, we will experience this, if we are sensitive, as a kind of punishment or beating. It is not about analysis. One gains the greatest insight into others through heartfelt accord. This nurturing of our relationship with the so-called dead is particularly necessary today, as it seems to me, because we live in a materialistic age. This is an evolutionary reality, not just a chance occurrence. Because of this, we are not able, before we cross the threshold of death, to fully develop and elaborate all our potential thoughts, feelings, and emotions. Since an unprocessed residue remains, once we have passed through the gate of death, it is necessary for the living to cultivate their relationship with the dead, enriching ordinary human life by this means. If only modern people could hear this, could understand that life will be impoverished if the dead are forgotten. And the only ones who can properly remember the dead are those who have in some way been karmically connected with them. We can cultivate direct communication with the dead, just as we do with the living. In the past, I have also said that these things are usually felt to be so difficult because they are unconscious. Yet not everything real is conscious, nor is everything unconscious unreal. If we cultivate this kind of relationship with the dead, then it exists, and the thoughts which remained undeveloped in their lifetime can enter life. What I am saying here is probably too much for modern people to take on board, but I say it because of a conviction based on spiritual realities that our social existence, our ethical and religious life, would be infinitely enriched if the living took advice from the dead. Nowadays, people think there is no need for someone to attain a certain age before offering others advice. It is thought best if people become city councillors and MPs at the youngest possible age, that they are mature enough to do this however young they may be. In former times, when greater knowledge of human nature prevailed, a person had to wait until a certain age to reach such positions. And now I'm even suggesting that we wait until a person dies and then ask his advice. Yet our era does need to hearken to the advice coming from the dead. It will be truly salutary if we try to hearken to them, and ultimately the only healing thing. Spiritual science does ask real energy of people, and they need to understand this. It asks people to try to act clearly and consistently. Today, amidst catastrophic events, the search for clarity is of the very greatest importance. The things we have been discussing today are connected, far more than people realize, with the great challenges of our day. Many years before this current catastrophe of the World War broke over us, in lecture cycles on the European folk souls, I tried to highlight some of the realities at work today in humanity in general. If you read the cycle entitled The Mission of the Individual Folk Souls in Relation to Teutonic Mythology, which I gave in Oslo, you can gain some insight into current events. It is not yet over. These things are still ongoing, and the cycle can offer some insight into events over the next few years. People's earthly relationships and circumstances can only really be understood by perceiving the spiritual impulses at work in them. The time is fast approaching when people will need to ask themselves how Eastern ways of thinking and feeling relate to those in Europe, and how these in turn relate to Western thinking, to that of America. All possible permutations of this question should be pondered. We can start already by asking how people in the Orient regard Europe. In the East, people look at Europe and have a sense that its culture and civilization are leading nowhere, leading to an abyss. An Oriental person has the feeling that in adopting what Europe can offer him, he ought not to lose the spirituality he has retained from ancient times. Easterners do not despise European machines, for instance, but, to quote the words of a renowned Oriental, in accepting the tools and machines that Europeans have created, they want to keep these in their proper place, in the tool shed, and not in their temples, nor in their dwellings, as Europeans do. In the East, it seems to people that Europeans have lost the ability to perceive the spirit in nature, the beauty in nature. Only in the East is it apparent that Europeans have sought to limit their thinking and actions to external mechanisms and to outward sensory reality. And in consequence, Oriental people feel called upon to reawaken ancient spirituality and save this for humanity. An Oriental who speaks of tangible spiritual realities, such as Rabindranath Tagore, in recent comments, believes that Europeans have integrated into their culture impulses only rendered possible by harnessing the devil to their cultural wagon. and that they are employing Satan's power to further their progress. Rabindranath Tagore believes that Eastern people must uncouple Satan again and bring spirituality to Europe once more. Here we find a phenomenon which sadly is too often overlooked today. Much has been excluded from our cultural evolution, which should have been introduced into it if it were to have really living spiritual substance, of the kind found in the works of Goethe, to name only one. You might object that Eastern people can find Goethe's works still alive in European culture today. But what do they actually see if they inquire more carefully? You may say that the Germans have founded a Goethe society. But let us imagine that an Oriental person wished to make closer acquaintance with this society and discover what it really stands for, since the great question of East and West is very topical at present and ultimately depends on spiritual impulses. This Oriental person could say the following: Goethe was such a decisive figure and so influential that in the 1890s it became possible, in a remarkable way, for his works to bear fruit for German culture when Countess Sophie of Saxon-Weimar took over his literary estate, caring for and cultivating it in an unparalleled way. This is true. But if we look at the Goethe Society and its public presence today, we discover that a few years back the post of president of this society became vacant. Of all possible candidates in the whole sphere of culture, a former finance minister was chosen to be this society's president. This is an external, but nevertheless striking fact. And such things are more important than people realize. It would be very important for people in the East, for whom spirituality is a vivid, keen, and real concern, to know that an anthroposophically oriented spiritual science exists here. But they cannot know this. It cannot reach them as yet, cannot penetrate everything else that is there and obstructs it, not only in this particular instance, of course. It is merely symptomatic of a more general malaise that the current president of the Goethe Society is a former finance minister. I could list endless other examples, of course. Here we find what I would say as a what I would see as a third necessity: thorough, reality-connected thinking. A thinking that makes no compromises and does not countenance lack of clarity. On my last trip, someone handed me a review of a book, a brief excerpt of which I will read here, starting with a quote from the book, quote, "Anyone who has ever graced the seats of a grammar school will have an unforgettable memory of the hours he spent enjoying Plato's dialogues between Socrates and his friends, unforgettable for the excruciating boredom they are bound to invoke. You may well remember that these dialogues struck you as amazingly stupid, though of course you did not dare say so, since Socrates was the Greek philosopher par excellence." With such sweeping generalizations, the book Socrates the Idiot by Alexander Moskowski, published by Dr. Eisler and Company Berlin, makes short shrift of the good Athenian, depriving him at a stroke of his dignity as a philosopher. Close quote. The first likely reaction of many people, on hearing that the author Moskowski has sought to show that Socrates was an idiot, is to consider this very strange, perhaps. And yet this relies on hazy thinking and compromise, rather than clear and precise thinking and a willingness to penetrate reality. I want to compare this with something else. Today books are published about the life of Jesus from a psychiatric angle. Such books investigate everything Jesus did from the perspective of modern psychiatry and compare it with all kinds of pathological forms of behavior. Such authors try to draw on the Gospels to demonstrate that Jesus was sick, that he must have been an epileptic, and that in fact the Gospels can only be understood from a Pauline point of view, and so on. You can read detailed reviews of these books. It is extremely easy to ignore things like this and pass them by with a smile. But realities lie somewhat deeper. If you subscribe fully to modern psychiatry, you will inevitably come to the same conclusions about the life of Jesus as the authors of these books. You cannot be authentic as a modern psychiatrist if you think in any other way. Nor, in the true sense of the word, can you be a modern psychiatrist if you think about Socrates in any other way than Alexander Moskowski does. You have to regard Socrates as an idiot. Moskowski is only distinguished from other adherents of these theories, who nevertheless think Socrates was not an idiot by his authenticity compared to them. They are untruthful while he speaks the truth as he must see it. He refuses all compromise. It is impossible to authentically subscribe to Alexander Moskowski's worldview and not to regard Socrates as an idiot. If you want the best of both worlds, to subscribe to a modern scientific worldview and, nevertheless, to value Socrates and not disparage him as an idiot, you become inauthentic. Likewise, you are untruthful as a modern psychiatrist if you accord a religious value to the life of Jesus. But modern people are shy of pursuing things to such a clear conclusion. For if they did, they would have to ask themselves some challenging questions. If they did not wish to regard Socrates as an idiot, they would have to try to find out more about him. And this would require them to reject a worldview such as that of Moskowski. Likewise, they would have to reject modern psychiatry if they came to see Jesus as the bearer of the greatest ideas ever known upon earth. We need a thinking oriented to reality, clear thinking that does not make the usual lazy compromises, which we can only avoid by being rigorously truthful. It is easy to feel indignant at someone like Moskowski calling Socrates an idiot, but he has to do so based on his worldview. To think consistently in this way is something people shy away from. They do not want to reject a modern view of the world, for this would make their lives still more uncomfortable. If they came to the conclusion that Socrates is not an idiot, after all, might they not have to acknowledge that Moskowski is one? He's not such a renowned figure, but there are very renowned figures who might then take a tumble. Anything could happen. You see, to penetrate the world of spirit, we need reality-oriented thinking. We have to see reality clearly. Thoughts are realities, and untrue thoughts are evil, inhibiting, destructive realities. It is no good pulling the wool over one's own eyes as to one's own untruthfulness by allowing Moskowski's worldview and that of Socrates to coexist. It is untruthful to allow both an equal place in your soul alongside each other as people do, as modern people do. We only become truthful if we are clear that we must either, like Moskowski, take up a purely scientific and mechanistic view of the world and regard Socrates as an idiot, or else realize that he was not, and then inevitably reject mechanistic views. They cannot coexist. Truthfulness is an ideal which modern people need to embrace. Thoughts are realities, and true thoughts are wholesome ones. Untrue thoughts, however much concealed by the mantle of circumspection in relation to one's own nature, create inner realities in us that obstruct and hinder the evolution of humanity and the world. The end of Lecture 4.